from WCVB Channel 5 Podcasts and SportsCenter 5. It's Take 5 with Chris Gasper.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of the Take 5 Podcast. Today's guest, Shalice Manza-Young, columnist for Yahoo Sports, coming to us all the way from the 2020 Tokyo Olympics, so Summer Olympics over in Japan, and she's nice enough to join us. It's really very early her time, but we talk about a lot. She dubs this the Mental Health Olympics. Obviously, a lot of talk, a lot of discussion about Simone Biles and her decision to remove herself from some events. I think that's something that could benefit other athletes down the line. It's been a fast track in Tokyo, but not always for Team USA, particularly the men. Shalice has a track background. She breaks it down for us. And I feel like Ellen has the best way to watch the Olympics, and it's not on NBC. And as well, what sport would we want to add to the Olympics? So, Ellen, there you go. I think I just set you up.
Yeah. I mean, if no one's been following along with the Olympics on TikTok, it has seriously been the best part of the Olympic coverage because these athletes have really all the time in the world if they're not in their events. They have so much extra time and they can't go anywhere.
That's true.
So they've all been TikToking from their inside the dining hall, inside their bedrooms. Like, what does this look like? What's a COVID test like? What does my room look like compared to my friend's room? A lot of jumping on the cardboard beds to show that they're extraordinarily sturdy. And the dining hall looks like out of this world.
Yeah, the Athletes Village is always really, really cool. And when I was there in 2016 for the Rio Olympics, we could actually go to some of that stuff. You know, I couldn't go in the dining hall, but you could sort of go in the Olympic Village, Athletes Village, I should say, a little bit. But now with COVID, obviously that's a no-go.
Yeah, I feel like the press really got the short end of the stick on this Olympics, big time.
And so the other question I have for you, and this is something you brought up, you know, what sport would you like to see added? Because there's always sports that I look at and I'm like, wait, this is an Olympic sport. And they've added regular sports like tennis and golf that I look at and I say, okay, this is a regular sport and it's great, but do we need an Olympic version of it or even baseball? It's not like you're getting all the best baseball players, but there are some pretty interesting ones and unusual ones that are in there. So what would you add?
So this year, skateboarding and surfing was added.
Okay.
For me, it seems like it should have always been there. But I would like to see race car driving added. And I know that's very cost prohibitive for so many countries.
Yeah.
But car racing is popular globally.
Yes.
And it's also viewed here in America as a huge sport. And in many parts of Europe, car racing is extraordinarily popular.
It is huge in Europe. Yes.
So I would like to see that.
No, that's interesting. Well, I mean, you know, they have equestrian. They have people. The horses do the work there. So the
exactly.
Cars,
yeah. What's the difference?
No, it's not all bad. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't mind seeing that. I don't think it's ever going to happen. I think the real dream.
If they're going to add esports, they're literally talking about adding video games to the Olympics.
Yeah, there you go.
Then race car drivers should be added to the Olympics.
Yeah, the esports. I'm anti esports in terms of adding that to the Olympics. Let them have their own thing. But that to me would be an assault and an insult to the athletes who train to compete in the Olympics. Speaking of the Olympics, we talk with someone who's there. She's been there from the beginning, from the opening ceremony. She'll be there until the closing ceremony. It's Shalice Manza-Young of Yahoo Sports. She's next.
Hey, Boston, let's talk sports. WCVB Sports Center 5, The Contact.
Source at MLB tells me.
Expert analysis.
That's going to be a major point of contention.
On air.
I talked to a high-ranking source.
And exclusive articles free on the WCVB app. Duke Castiglione, Chris Gasper, Bob Halloran, and special correspondent Mike
Once
Lynch.
Again,
the strongest team covering Boston's teams.
The only game in town.
WCVB Sports Center 5 on Boston's news leader.
All right, now we're joined all the way from Tokyo, Japan and the Summer Olympics by Shalice Manza-Young, award-winning sports columnist for Yahoo Sports. Shalice, thanks for taking the time to join us. I know it's pretty early your time.
Of course, Chris. Thanks for having me.
So I'll start here. I know this is your first Olympics, so maybe you don't sort of have the reference point of comparing it to something else, but I'm really fascinated by this Olympics with no fans and with the fact that over in Japan towards the end here, it seemed like they really didn't want this Olympics to happen. So what has it been like over there and what has been the reception from the Japanese people to hosting these Olympics in the middle of a pandemic?
So I was in the stadium for the opening ceremony. And I've been in the same stadium for the last week because of the track and field meet. And so on the night of the opening ceremony, there was absolutely just, there was no energy. you know, there were, of course, some people there from the IOC to pat themselves on the back that they got this going, and, you know, dignitaries and their family. But I would imagine that during the Parade of Nations, typically there's just, you know, big ovations, depending on the size of the country or how many fans they might have who were able to make the trip. And there was just no energy. But you could hear a not small, but very loud protest happening outside.
Oh, wow.
In the plaza. As it happens, the Japanese Olympic Museum, and there's a plaza, is right outside the stadium. So you could hear this protest, and in Japanese, they were saying no Olympics. And I don't remember what else, but, you know, they're basically chanting and making it be known that they weren't happy about the Olympics. But since then, and every day that I've been at the track, there is a giant, you know, one of those statues of the five rings in that plaza outside the Japanese Olympic Museum. And even though in the middle of the day, it's about 95 degrees with 70% humidity, there's always hundreds of people milling around that statue, they wait in line to take pictures and selfies in front of the rings and taking pictures of the stadium and, you know, just there to be as close, that's as close to the games as they can get. There were a lot of fans, the bike road race and the triathlon, I think, because, you know, you can't stop people from getting on the road and standing on the side of the road. But yeah, that's it. I know that public sentiment here because of COVID, there is a majority of people in polling who didn't want it here, but there are at least some people who are excited and are looking for any way they could to just be near the games.
What is it like, in your opinion, for the athletes here in terms of some of the COVID protocols and what goes on? You know, I was fortunate enough to cover the Olympics in Rio in 2016, and we were actually able to go over to the athletes' village. Are you able to do that as a media member? How much are they able to interact with each other in the athletes' village?
I think they can interact with each other. I follow a few of the American track and field stars on Instagram. And of course, they're able to go to the cafeteria in the athletes' village. Like everything here, everywhere here, there's, of course, plastic up on, you know, three sides. If you're sitting at a table, if you're sitting across from somebody, if you're sitting next to somebody, there's a plastic barrier between you and them. But they do see each other. We cannot go anywhere near the athletes' village. In mixed zone, which is, as you know, Chris, for international events, the mixed zone is where media speak to athletes. There's literally, they keep us 6 feet away from the athletes. So mixed zone, normally you would be almost face to face with somebody. And now we're, you know, trying to make sure they can understand us through face masks and for 6 or 7 feet away. And one funny thing about the mix zone is that they are doing the mix zone is first come, first serve. So it's ticketed. And when you get to the entrance, if there's a ticket, you get one. If not, you have to stand outside the barrier with like 50 other people. So it's a weird sort of like you're trying to control who's inside the fencing because of COVID.
Yes.
But literally on the other side of the fence, you might be with like 25 other people crammed together trying to hear, you know, Elaine Thompson-Herah talk about another win that she had.
Wow. I mean, do you feel like the Olympic spirit is still there, you know, when you're in the venues? Like I mentioned before, I know there's no fans, but is there still sort of that Olympic spirit? I mean, so many of these athletes, Shalice, they've worked their entire lives for these opportunities and for these moments. And there have been some great moments in this Olympics, and there's always some heartbreaking ones too. But without the fans there, do you still have that same feel, that same Olympic spirit?
Not really. You know, I'd have to say not really. I was at tennis the first couple of days to see Naomi Osaka. I saw Novak Djokovic stadium court, and there's some applause from sometimes the volunteers, especially for Osaka, because, you know, she's Japanese and represents Japan. So volunteers who could, they kind of came in and were standing and watching. And so they would clap for her. But otherwise, you know, you're in this big tennis stadium and there's nothing. And at the track, they do the medal ceremonies on sort of a rolling basis. And some people are fortunate, you know, like the Italian high jumper and the Italian 100 meter winner.
Yes.
The media here, international media, don't seem to adhere by the same rules that American media do. As you know, there's not supposed to be any clapping in the press box. And the night that within 30 minutes, Italy won the high jump gold and the 100 meter gold, the media section was going crazy. And so they will they'll clap during the medal ceremony for if it's, you know, an Italian, or I've met some men from Kenya, and it's sort of like state TV. So it's a little bit complicated, obviously.
Kind of sounds like the Patriots, Shalice.
But yeah, it's weird because you have to imagine Elaine Thompson-Herah stands on the top of the medal ceremony, and there's people waving Jamaican flags and screaming and cheering and all that kind of stuff when their countrywoman, especially for the women's 100, they swept, you know. I can just imagine what that medal ceremony would have been had there been fans, and how many Jamaica flags would have been in the stands, and people just, you know, dancing and cheering and clapping because their little island nation yet again produced three Olympic gold medalists.
You know, I want to mention something that you talked about there in terms of the medal presentations. From what I've seen, and we've been told, you know, normally the athletes, you bow your head and they put the medal on, but they have to put the medals on themselves. Is that correct?
Yeah, they do. It's a COVID thing.
And what does that look like? And have you talked to any athletes? I'm just curious about that. The idea of, okay, I'm just gonna, you know, be up here, I'm on the medal, I'm on the medal platform, and I'll just put my own medal on, and now they'll play my national anthem.
You know what's funny? I haven't asked an individual medalist. I went to 3 meter springboard diving one day, just sort of on a whim, and the American men took silver. And in team situations, this has actually been a good thing, because in team situations, you'll see teammates place the medals on each other. And so it's sort of like this endearing gesture, because these people, whether they're a team of two or a team of, you know, 15, like the women's softball team, they've spent hours and weeks, and in some cases years, working together toward this goal. And so it just sort of solidifies the bond that they're the ones that get to, you know, medal each other. And so the American male springboard athletes, I did happen to ask, and they said, yeah, it was really cool. And that was one of the rare silver linings that happened because of COVID.
Yeah, that does sound pretty cool, the way you describe that. That's really great. And I wonder if it's one of those things that will sort of become like the entrance for the Super Bowl, where the Patriots started something in Super Bowl 36, where you come out as a team and nobody had done that before. And now almost all the teams come out as a team. So maybe moving forward, this is something that maybe this is sort of a silver lining of COVID, and that moving forward, the athletes will put the medals on themselves or on each other.
Yeah, it's sweet. It's like, you know, when you get married and you put the rings on each other, and it sort of seals the vow, and it makes it really official because they put the medals on each other.
I like that. I want to talk to you a little bit about what's gone on over there. It certainly has been an Olympics with no shortage of news, no shortage of storylines, no shortage of memorable moments. I want to start with Simone Biles and the reaction there to her pulling out of some of the individual competitions. Obviously, she was able to do the balance beam, but she didn't do individual all around or some of the other apparatuses. And then also, you know, pulling out of the team where the U.S. got silver. I, for one, have been surprised and heartened by how much positive feedback she's gotten on her decision to pull out. And she says she has the twisties in terms of the idea of just not knowing where you are in the air. I can't even imagine that for somebody at her level as a gymnast to just launch yourself and be in a situation where you're twisting and flipping your body and you have no idea how you're going to land or if you're going to land. So what's your take on that? Do you think that she has been positively received overall? Or am I maybe painting too rosy a picture of the situation?
I think in a general sense she has. And you're right. You know, it was really heartening to see the day after, or as it was, you know, unfolding that she was pulling out of the team event, you of course saw, you know, a lot of mostly men criticizing her, and videos that called her a psychopath. And it's from somebody who, of course, is nothing but a bad faith merchant, that video, and just helps gin up the rage machine when there's some new culture war to try to undertake, you know, Dr. Seuss and Starbucks cups, and now Simone Biles is a psychopath. So what I think has been happened, what's really amazing to see, is this has almost become the mental health Olympics, because Simone, other athletes have discussed it, but more and more athletes are being asked and acknowledging, especially because of COVID, you know, especially because when you're at this level as an athlete in many sports, your entire, the Olympic cycle every 4 years, everything you do over those 4 years is pointed toward July 23rd, the day the Olympics started. You are supposed to be in absolute peak condition when those Olympics start, assuming you make the team for your country. So, and then to find out that they weren't happening, everything's thrown into turmoil because it's pushed back a year. And so that was really hard mentally, on top of all the other things that they might be going through on a regular basis. And what they're saying, in a way, is, you know, the message they're sending is it's okay for people who aren't elite athletes. You know, that's one of the things that frustrates me the most when I used to cover the NFL and things like that. And you know this too, Chris, is people would, well, these guys have so much money, what does it matter? Well, first of all, if you're a professional track and field athlete, as an American especially, you're not making that much money. But also, money is great if you have mental health issues, because it means you can, you know, find a therapist, which a lot of, you know, quote unquote, regular people cannot, but it doesn't mean that you don't have issues. And as Simone said, you know, the pressure is immense. The pressure that you're supposed to, the way it's hyped up, you know, it's every 4 years. If you don't medal and you're expected to medal, you have to wait 4 years for this other opportunity. And there's so much emphasis put on your country. And, you know, you have the support system at home of coaches and friends and family and all these people who support you in various different ways, sometimes financial. You know, Raven Saunders, who won a silver medal for the United States in women's shot put, she came across one of those foolish websites that said her net worth was between $1 million and $3 million. This was literally only a couple of weeks before she came to Tokyo.
Okay.
And she screenshot her bank account because she had negative $501.
Oh my God, really?
Yes. And when her fans saw that, some people were kind enough to give a little bit of money here and there. They wound up giving, she said, $1,200, but it was enough to bring her account positive and for her to shop for toiletries and other things she would need to make this trip. So imagine the pressure of now you're supposed to medal. Like, she came in here as a medal favorite. You have your friends and your family and your coaches. And then on top of that, you have these people, some of them strangers, who have donated their own money to support you. And just how it must feel to be like, I can't let any of these people down. I have to represent for these people. I have to make these people proud of me.
No, it's a very good point. Ellen?
I wanted to echo what you just said about how mental health and being able to focus on mental health in a way is a privilege. I think it's a privilege that a lot of people in America have and a lot of people globally do not have. A lot of people are just looking for their next meal. They can't even think about how they're feeling as people. So I wanted to know, did the global press or athletes that you know, did they react to the Simone Biles news the way that we feel that America did? Did they understand the concept of putting mental health first in front of pride for one's country, I guess, if you will?
That's a really good question. I'm not sure. My colleague Dan Wetzel was at the gymnastics arena every day for us from a media standpoint. But it is a really good question because, as you said, in other places, they will tell you to just suck it up and you're fine and stop being weak and things like that. There's still that language. So it was funny, not funny necessarily, but last night we spoke to Noah Lyles, American men's 200 meter bronze medalist. And Noah has always been pretty open about his struggles. He has depression and things like that. And one of the European journalists asks him, like, why are you guys so brave now? This never would have happened. And I'm sure it is a curiosity for some people, because as you said, it's not everyone has gotten to the point that the United States has, that mental health is health, period. And you have to be taking care of your entire body to, you know, be at your peak. And it's okay to say, something's not right. Maybe I need to talk to somebody about this.
And I think what's great about this just overall, and we've seen a lot of this, Shalice and Ellen, is that, you know, athletes are making sure that people don't define them just as athletes, that they are three-dimensional mm-hmm. people. And it's not just that two-dimensional image. And they're letting people know, you know, I'm a human being and I'm affected by things that happen in my community or things that are happening when it comes to global health. And these things affect me. You know, I don't just exist to compete and to entertain. I think we've seen that in major North American professional sports. We've seen that certainly in global sports like the English Premier League, and we're seeing that at the Olympics. And I think it's a good reminder for people. I think it's really sort of easy to just diminish these athletes and reduce them to just performers that exist solely to entertain you every 4 years. And that's obviously not the case at all. Speaking of entertainment, though, I will say, I mean, I think the track and field has been very entertaining, and I know that's particularly near and dear to your heart, Shalice, based on your experience both as an athlete and a coach, a decorated athlete in the state of Rhode Island in track and field. And you walked on at Syracuse, right?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, walked on at Syracuse and have coached track and field. So what has it been like to cover track and field at the Olympics for you, and what's really sort of stood out to you?
From a personal standpoint, it's kind of a dream come true. You know, it's funny, as a journalist, again, we're trained that we're not supposed to play favorites and all of those kinds of things. But I will tell you, I'm exhausted. I'm absolutely exhausted, because I'm at the track from 8:45 until midnight, 8:45 a.m. until midnight.
Oh my God, really?
And I'm, the action starts at 9. And part of that is, like, there might be prelims at 9, but I don't want to miss it because it might feed into a story I have to write after the finals or something like that. And I just feel like I'm supposed to be here. Johnny Ludden, the editor-in-chief of Yahoo Sports, when the opportunity came because of the delay because of COVID, I said to him, I was like, can I go? And I was like, if you let me go and just tell me to sit at the track, I will be happy as a pig in poop. And he was like, okay. And so that's how I pitched it. So now I had to, you know, it's just been a dream from a professional standpoint. And, you know, from a standpoint of the performances, it's been a little disappointing after all the discussion we just had about the pressure of medals, but it's been a little disappointing so far for the American track team. The women are coming through. The men have been a little bit disappointing. You know, the one that's going to stick out to me is the mixed 4x400 relay. This is the first time that they've had it in the Olympics. They did have it at the last World Championships in 2019, and USA ran away with it. And there was a controversy because in the first round, in the preliminary round, they said that, and this, it did happen that the second American runner lined up completely in the wrong place. On track and field, there are zones, exchange zones, and you can be, the baton has to be passed within the arrows of the zone. And the American woman who was receiving the baton second runner, she was way past the zone, and it looked weird at the time. And then when they finished and they won their heat, it said that the United States was disqualified. Well, come to find out, the United States said that the official told her to stand there.
Oh, wow.
And that Michael Johnson, who is here as a broadcaster, he saw in the second heat that officials tried to line up other people in the wrong spot, but those people realized that something wasn't right and got in position in the proper spot before it became a problem. So the United States appeals, they win, they're in the final, and they lost to Poland and the Dominican Republic at the line and got bronze. And the United States has been so dominant in the 4x4. It was just, I still don't understand what happened. I think they tried to, you know, let the athletes who made it in the individual 4x4 and the 400 hurdles, let them focus on their own events. So the men and women who were in the final were the number 4 and number 5 finishers at the United States trials instead of one of the top 3 who competed here as an individual. But, you know, that was a little bit embarrassing. but it's been really great. The men's and women's 400 hurdle races, to see those world records go down the way that they did. And it was expected. If you follow track, Carsten Warholm and Rye Benjamin, they have a great rivalry. Warholm just broke the world record by only a couple of hundredths of a second in July. And Benjamin ran the third fastest time of all time in the US trials. So coming here, there was certainly expectation that one or both of them might run really well and break the world record again. And then Sydney McLaughlin and Dalila Muhammad, the two American women, they came into Tokyo having broken the world record the last 3 times they had run against each other.
Wow.
And even they expected that they were going to break the record again, whichever one of them won the gold medal. And it turned out, in the case with the men's 400 hurdles, that both the gold and silver medalists broke the previous world record by over a half second. It was very similar with Sydney and Dalila yesterday, and just incredible, incredible performances, incredible in a sport that's, you know, hundredths and tenths of a second make all the difference between winning and losing and medals and bonus money from your sponsors that you might desperately need. Just to see these performances, it's really incredible.
Yeah, and I have to say that I was somewhat emotionally invested in Sydney McLaughlin's attempt to win, and she obviously set the new world record and took home gold in the 400 meter hurdles there with a time of 51.46 seconds, because I had covered her in Rio when she was young. She was like 17 years old and mm-hmm. was sort of taking everything in. And you could sort of see that she was going to be the next big thing in US women's track and field. But that was a learning experience for her in Rio. And it was probably really, you know, she'd gone to the Olympic trials, but it was eye opening. You know, I think a lot of times she was used to stepping on the track and automatically being the best person, and she wasn't, and she barely qualified, you know, moving forward out of her heat. But she really handled it very well and handled it with a ton of maturity, I thought, and perspective. And it was so great to see that here we are 5 years later, and she's gone from a teenager to a young woman who is polished and accomplished and at the top of her field. So I was really happy to see, you know, Sydney set that record and go from there. I do want to ask you a little bit about the men's side. I think when you look at Trayvon Bromell and some of the other men, you're right. I think relative to the history of USA track and field and what was expected here, they've underperformed a little bit. Do you have any idea why that is? Because this is a fast track. And I know in Rio, the discussion was that it wasn't a fast track. There was some disappointment. Usain Bolt and others were disappointed, you know, with the track. It just wasn't a fast track. This seems like it's a fast track, which would play into the hands of the U.S. sprinters.
It was a fast track, and it helped. It's helped other people, but it hasn't really helped, you know, a lot of the American sprinters, not on the men's side. Bromell was a disappointment. Noah Lyles, he looked a little bit off even at the trials.
Okay.
He did end up coming up with gold, but then, you know, somebody like Andre DeGrasse, who was the bronze medalist in the 100 and finally got his gold medal last night. Andre had 5 or 6 world medals between world championships and Olympics, and they were all silver and bronze. So last night he finally got his gold, and he did it by running 2 Canadian national records in the semifinals and finals. So for some people, you know, for Lamont Jacobs from Italy, who literally nobody heard of. I mean,
yeah, I was wondering if you knew about him, because you know more about track and field than anybody I know.
No, that's the thing. None of us, you know, people front in the mix zone after that 100 race, everyone pulled out their phones and was Googling, trying to find some information about who is this guy. And people were saying, yeah, he was born in Texas. Well, yeah, but he barely speaks English because he moved to Italy with his mother when he was like
6 months,
a toddler, you know, still in diapers. Yes. So I saw a friend of mine who is a Texan, an incredibly proud Texan, tweet about, yeah, he was born here. And I was like, you got to let that go.
Because that's amazing to think, though, that in 2021, like, you know how much information we know about everything. Like, it's very rare for somebody to just come completely off the radar and win a gold medal.
No, 100%. I think, you know, you mentioned Trayvon Bromell, and he came here with the two fastest times in the world. He had run 9.68 and 9.70, if memory serves. And he didn't even advance to the final. He just didn't look himself with the media. He had no real answer. It's not like he could point to, yeah, unfortunately, I came in here with like a tweaked hamstring, or I hurt my back on the bad mattresses in the athlete's village. He literally just said, I have no idea what happened. But yeah, we saw Fred Curley, who kind of shocked everyone when he dropped from the 400 all the way down to the 100 in the 200 at US trials. But Fred Curley won a silver medal in the 100. So I guess you can't doubt his decision making. And Arian Knighton, of the three men, all three American men did make it to the final in the 200 last night. Arian Knighton is a 17-year-old high schooler from Tampa.
Wow.
Who really only first stepped onto the track to get better at football. And now will not, like, he was asked last night and he was like, nope, I am not a football player anymore. I am a sprinter. And he finished fourth in the Olympics at 17 years old. The bronze medalist was Noah Lyles, who is, I believe, only 24 or 25. And the silver medalist, Kenny Bednarik, is only 22. So does that, you know, mean that they are the future? And then the other one who wasn't there was Christian Coleman, who really, you know, had history played out. Christian Coleman should have been the gold medal winner in the 100. But he was not where he was supposed to be for three drug tests, and they don't play with that.
Yes.
So he's suspended for a couple years. So, and even it extended to, you know, Michael Norman in the 400 through the rounds. He hasn't quite looked, it's something's looked a little off. He hasn't looked as dominant as you would expect him to in the rounds. In the 800 final last night, Clayton Murphy was a medalist at the last Olympics. And he faded and finished like eighth of the eight men who made the final, I believe. And, you know, really could have been, or is expected to be, I should say, a medalist in the men's 800. So it's been weird. But other countries, they have resources too. And a lot of them value track and field on a national level, and want, you know, do what they can to support the athletes on the global stage. And the United States just doesn't have that.
Yeah, you're right. I think with the United States, sometimes we think winning these races is just like our birthright. And I do think it's probably good that there's, you know, a little bit more parity, sort of across track and field. And you mentioned Jamaica, which is obviously a real powerhouse. I have to ask you this question from a personal standpoint. When Elaine Thompson-Herah broke FloJo's Olympic record, were you excited that you were there for it? Or were you sad that she broke FloJo's record? Because I know FloJo is a personal hero of yours.
I was excited, but JJK is my hero and nobody's touching her records right now. So it's okay.
Fair. Yep. Jackie Joyner Kersee. That's fair. But I mean, an amazing performance for her. And I think another thing on track and field that I've liked of this Olympics, I think, has been, Shalice, that, you know, I think the women have deservedly so really gotten top billing. And I know, you know, you had a tweet sometimes back here in the United States, people are relating these athletes to the sports that they know. And you don't always agree with that. But I think that overall, it's been really nice. And again, really sort of heartening to see the women really get top billing on the track.
It has been, especially for the American women, they're carrying the team. And so that's great. And obviously, when you look at the schedule, there's a 13-hour time difference between the East Coast of the United States and Tokyo. So the fact that you had Sydney McLaughlin, I watched her run yesterday at like 11 a.m., you know, 11:30 a.m., I think it was, so that it could be shown at 10:30 p.m. live on the East Coast in the United States. And, you know, it's similar with a few other races that they, you know, NBC, I'm sure, because they pay so much money to broadcast the Olympics, they have sway over the timing of certain events so that they can be shown live back home in the United States. And so even if you look at the timing, I'm pretty sure the women's 400, because of course, the great Allyson Felix, she did make it to the final last night. So she will be running for her 10th Olympic medal. She probably will go for an 11th as part of the women's 4x4 team. So yeah, if you look at the timing of these events when they're happening here versus, you know, you can kind of see what they were, what NBC expected to be marquee events. The schedule is done probably about a year before the Olympics happen, but they're trying to play an anticipation game of what they think are going to be the marquee events. And so far they've lived up.
Yeah, absolutely. So as we sort of close things out here, we all know how much you love the track and field. I mean, that's so obvious. And I can't think of anybody better suited from the United States really to cover it than you. But one of the things I loved about covering the Olympics was I got to see sports that I never would have watched. And I remember going to a table tennis matchup between China and Japan, and the intensity just blew me away. Like, I didn't know anything about the sport, but just how intense they were and how much it meant to them, I was like, this is really cool. And I remember that to this day. So what other sport has stood out to you other than the track and field that you've gotten to experience?
I get to go to water polo, and holy cow, those women are incredible. You know, I've been an avid watcher of the Olympics, and so, you know, they might play the women's gold medal water polo match or something like that. So like, I'd seen it before on television, but then being there and they have the underwater cameras now and just really watching it more closely, they are wrestling with each other for this ball in the water, and they can't touch the bottom of the pool. The pool has to be at least 7 feet deep in water polo. And then the reason I went, specifically chose to go to water polo, is because the U.S. women are dominant, and the best goalkeeper in the world to a lot of people in the water polo world on the women's side is a woman named Ashley Johnson, and she's Black. And to see a Black woman in a sport that is, you know, traditionally, she's the first Black woman to represent the United States in water polo at the Olympics, which this is her second. She was at 2016. But she's just an incredible athlete. I mean, again, she is treading water for 32 minutes. They were 8 minute quarters, and there, of course, are four quarters. Halftime is only 3 minutes, and she doesn't come out of the pool. She stays in the pool and treads water. And if somebody shoots high on her, can launch herself out of the water, again, can't touch the bottom of the pool, and she can still get out of the water to like her thighs.
Oh, wow.
Just incredible. Absolutely incredible. And so watching water polo and getting to speak with Ashley, she's such a great ambassador, and she's so passionate about making sure that more Black children and kids that look like her experience water polo. But even more than that, because of the history that we have in this country with public pools being closed rather than integrating them, and that has led to Black children being 5 times more likely to drown in pools than white children. You know, she knows all of that, and she is doing what she can to spread the word and participates in programs to make sure that Black children get access to pools, get swimming lessons, and to try to help bring that number down. So it was a great conversation. It was incredible to watch the American women play water polo. And that was one of my favorite things.
And that's what the Olympics are about. You know, you are exposed to sports and cultures and people that you otherwise would not be. And that's why I like it. I always say it's sort of like the Super Bowl on steroids, which is maybe not the right thing to say when you're talking about the Olympics. You don't want to mention performance enhancers, but it is. It makes you realize how small the world really is, both how large it is because you see all the countries, but also how small it is, how similar we all are. So, Shalice, you're doing a great job over there. I know it's a grind. I've been through it before, and you're putting in some really long days on track and field, but we're all benefiting from it. And as your friend, I'm really proud of you, and I'm enjoying your work. So enjoy the rest of the Olympics and get home safe.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Shalice. Thanks for listening to this edition of the Take 5 podcast. We appreciate it as always. Don't forget to subscribe and rate the podcast so others can find it and enjoy it. And now you can email us at take5@wcvb.com. We'd love to get your feedback and hear your thoughts. We'll catch you next time.